Down on the Farm by Charles Stross. Ah, the joy of summer. Here in the southeast of England, it's only the season of mosquitoes, sunburn, and water shortages. I'm a city boy, so you can add stifling pollution to the list as a million outwardly mobile families start their Chelsea tractors and race to their holiday camps. That's before we consider the hellish environs of a tube, which are far more literally hellish than anyone realises. Unless they've looked at a Transport for London journey planner and recognised the hellish or recondite geometry underlying the superimposed sigils of the underground map. But I digress. One morning, my deputy head of department wanders into my office. It's cramped, and I'm busy practising my frisbee throw with a stack of beer mats and a dartboard decorated with various cabinet ministers. Bob. Andy pauses to pluck a moist cardboard square out of the air as I sit up, guiltily. A job's just come up that you might like to look at. I think it's right up your street. Now, the first law of bureaucracy is, show no curiosity outside your cubicle. It's like the first law of every army that's ever bashed a square, never volunteer. If you ask questions, or volunteer, it will be taken as a sign of inactivity, and the devil, in the person of your line manager or your sergeant, will find a task for your idle hands. What's more, you'd better believe it'll be less appealing than whatever you were doing before, creatively idling, for instance, because inactivity is a crime against organisation and must be punished. That goes double here in the laundry, the branch of a British secret state tasked with defending the realm from the scum of the multiverse, using tools of applied computational demonology. If you volunteer for the wrong job, you can end up with soul-sucking horrors from beyond space-time using your brain for a midnight snack. But I don't think I could get away with feigning overwork right now, and besides, he's packaged it up as a mystery. Andy knows how to bait my hook, damn it. What kind of job is it? There's something odd going on down at the funny farm. He gives a weird little chuckle. The trouble is going to be telling whether it's just the usual or a more serious deviation. Normally I'd ask Boris to check it out, but he's not available this month. It has to be an SSO2 or higher, and I can't go over there myself. So how about it? Call me impetuous, not to mention a little bored, but I'm not stupid. And while I'm far enough down the management ladder that I have to squint to see daylight, I'm an SSO3. Which means I can sign off on petty cash authorizations up to the price of a pencil and get to sit in on interminable meetings when I'm not tackling eldritch horrors in human resources. I even get to represent my department on international liaison junkets when I don't dodge fast enough. Not so quick. Why can't you go? Have you got a meeting scheduled or something? Most likely it's a 5-course lunch with his opposite number from the dustbin liaison committee, knowing Andy. But if so, and if I take the job, that's all for the good. He'll end up owing me. Andy pulls a face. It's not the usual. I would go, but they might not let me out again. Huh? They? Who are they? The nurses. He looks me up and down, as if he's never seen me before. It's kind of weird. What's gotten into him? They're sensitive to the stench of magic. It's okay for you, Bob. You've only been working here, what, 6 years? All you need to do is turn off your pockets and turn everything inside out before you go in, and make sure you're not carrying any gizmos, electronic or otherwise. But I've been here coming up on 15 years, and the longer you've been in the laundry, it gets under your skin. Visiting the funny farm isn't a job for an old hand. It has to be someone new and fresh who isn't likely to attract their professional attention. Someone like you. Call me slow, but finally I figure out what this is about. Andy wants me to go because he's afraid. See, I told you the rules, didn't I? Anyway, that's why, less than a week later, I am admitted to a lunatical asylum, for that is what the Gothic engraving on the stone Victorian workhouse lintel assures me it is. Luckily, mine is not an emergency admission, but you can never be too sure. The old saw that there are some things that mortal men were not meant to know cuts deep in my line of work. Laundry staff, the laundry is what we call the organisation, not a description of what it does, are sometimes exposed to mind-blasting horrors in the course of our business. I'm not just talking about the usual PowerPoint presentations and self-assessment sessions to which any bureaucracy is prone. They're more like the mythical worst things that happen at sea, especially in the vicinity of drowned alien cities occupied by tentacled horrors. No, when one of our numbers needs psychiatric care, they're not going to get it in a normal hospital of our care in the community. We don't want agents babbling classified secrets in public, even in the relatively safe confines of their own padded cell. Perforce, we take care of our own. I'm not going to tell you what town the funny farm is embedded in. Like many of our establishments, it's a building of a certain age, confiscated by the government during the Second World War and not returned to its former owners. It's hard to find. It sits in the middle of a triangle of grubby shopping streets that have seen better days, and every building that backs onto it sports a high, windowless brick wall. All but one, anyway. If you enter a small grocery store, walk through the stockroom into the backyard, then unlatch a nondescript wooden gate and walk down a gloomy, soot-stained alley, you'll find a dank alleyway. You won't do this without authorization, mind you. It's protected by wards powerful enough to cause projectile vomiting in frequent burglars. But if you did, and if you followed the alley to the end, you'd come to a heavy green wooden door, surrounded by narrow windows with black painted cast iron bars. A dull, pitted plaque next to the doorbell proclaims it to be St. Hilda of Grantham's home for disgruntled waifs and strays. Except that most of them aren't so much disgruntled as demonically possessed when they arrive at these gates. It smells faintly of boiled cabbage and existential despair. I take a deep breath and yank the bell pull. Nothing happens, of course. I phoned ahead to make an appointment, but even so, someone's got to unlock a bunch of doors and then lock them again before they can get to the entrance and let me in. They take security seriously there, Andy told me. Can't risk some of the battier inmates getting loose, you know. Just how dangerous are they? I'd asked. Mostly they're harmless to other people, he shuddered. But the secure ward, don't try and go there on your own. Not that the sisters will let you, but I mean, don't even think about trying it. Some of them are... We owe them a duty of care and a debt of honour and all that. They fell in the line of duty, but that's scant consolation for you if a senior operations officer who succumbed to paranoid schizophrenia decides you're a blue Hades and gets hold of some red chalk and a hypodermic needle before your next visit, huh? Think about it. The thing is, magic is a branch of applied mathematics, and the inmates here are not only mad, they're computer science graduates. That's why they came to the attention of a laundry in the first place, and it's also why they ultimately ended up in the farm, where we can keep them away from sharp pointy things and diagrams with the wrong sort of angles. But it's difficult to make sure they're safe. You can solve theorems with a blackboard if you have to, after all, or in your head if you dare. Green crayon on the walls of a padded cell takes on a whole different level of menace in the funny farm. In fact, many of the inmates aren't allowed writing implements at all, and blank paper is carefully controlled, never mind electronic devices of any kind. I'm mulling over these grim thoughts when there's a loud clunk from a door and a panel just large enough to admit one person opens inward. Mr. Howard, I'm Dr. Renfield. You're not carrying any electronic or electrical devices or professional implements, fetishes or charms? I shake my head. Good. If you'd like to come this way, please. Renfield is a mild-looking woman, slightly mousy in a tweed skirt and white lab coat, with a perpetually harried expression of someone who is a full Filofax and hasn't worked out yet that her watch is losing an hour a day. I hurry along behind her, trying to guess her age. 35? 45? I give up. How many inmates do you have, exactly? I ask. We come to a portcullis-like door, and she pauses, fumbling with an implausibly large key ring. 18 at last count, she says. Come on, we don't want to annoy Matron. She doesn't like people obstructing the corridors. There are steel rails recessed into the floor, like a diminutive narrow-gauge railway. The corridor walls are all painted institutional cream, and I notice after a moment that the light is coming through windows set high up in the walls. Odd-looking devices like armoured glass chandeliers hang from pipes just out of reach. They're gas lamps, Renfield says abruptly. I twitch. She's noticed my surreptitious inspection. We can't use electric lights except for Matron, of course. Come into my office and I'll fill you in. We go through another door. Oak, darkened with age, looking more like it belongs in a stately home than a lunatic asylum, except for two prominent locks. Suddenly we're in Mahogany Row. Thick wool carpets, brass doorknobs and light switches, not to mention overstuffed armchairs. Okay, so the carpet is faded with age and transected by more of the parallel rails, but it's still officer country. Renfield's office opens off one side of this reception area, and at the other end I see closed doors and a staircase leading up to another floor. This is the administrative wing, she explains as she opens the door. Tea or coffee? Coffee, thanks, I say, sinking into a leather-encrusted armchair that probably dates to the last but one century. Renfield nods and pulls a discreet cord above the doorframe, then drags her office chair out from behind her desk. I can't help noticing that not only does she not have a computer, but her desk is dominated by a huge and ancient manual typewriter. An Imperial Aristocrat 66 with wide carriage upgrade and adjustable tabulator, I guess, although I'm not really an expert on office appliances that are twice as old as I am. One wall is covered in wooden filing cabinets. There might be as much as 30 megabytes of data stored in them. You do everything on paper, I understand. That's right. She nods, serious-faced. Too many of our clients aren't safe around modern electronics. We even have to be careful what games we let them play. Lego and Meccano are completely banned, of course. There was a nasty incident involving a game of Cluedo back before my time. Any board game that has a non-deterministic set of rules can be dangerous in the wrong hands. The door opens. Tea for two, says Renfield. I look round, expecting an orderly, and freeze. Mr. Howard, this is Nurse Gearbox, she introduces. Nurse Gearbox, this is Mr. Howard. Oh, he is not a new admission, she adds hastily, as the thing in the doorway swivels its head towards me with a menacing hiss of hydraulics. There's a loud whirring, clanking noise. Mr. Howard, welcome to... Ching! St. Hilda's? The thing in the very old-fashioned nurse's uniform, old enough that its origins as a 19th century nun's habit are clear, regards me with an unblinking panopticon stare. Where its nose should be, something like a witchfinder's wand points at me, stellate and articulated. Its face is a brass death mask, mouth a metal grill that seems to grimace at me in pointed distaste. Nurse Gearbox is one of our eight sisters, explains Dr. Renfield. They're not fully autonomous. I can see a rope-thick bundle of cables trailing from under the hem of a sister's floor-length skirt, presumably concealing something other than legs. They're controlled by Matron, who lives in the two sub-basement levels under the administration block. Matron started life as an IBM 1602 mainframe back in the day, with a summoning pentacle and a trapped Class 4 lesser nameless manifestation constrained to provide the higher cognitive functions. It's a grid, please, not a pentacle, I twitch. Matron is electrically powered. Yes, Mr. Howard, we allow electrical equipment in Matron's basement, as well as here in the staff suite, but only the areas accessible to the patients have to be kept power-free. The sisters are fully equipped to control unseemly outbursts, pacify the overstimulated, and conduct basic patient care tasks. They also have Vollmann Flesch formaturgic fixometers for detecting when patients are in danger of doing themselves a mischief, so I would caution you to keep any occult activities to a minimum in their presence. Despite their hydraulic delay line controls, their reflexes are very fast. I nod appreciatively. When was the system built? The set of Dr. Renfield's jaw tells me that she's bored with the subject or doesn't want to go there for some reason. That will be all, sister, she says. The door closes as if on oiled hinges. She waits for a moment, head cocked as if listening for something, and then she relaxes. The change is remarkable. She goes from stressed-out psychiatrist to tired housewife in 0 seconds flat, and smiles tiredly. Sorry about that. For some things you really shouldn't talk about in front of the sisters. Among others, Matron is very touchy about how long she's been here, and everything they hear, she hears. Oh, right. Did Mr. Neustrom brief you about this installation before he pitched you in at the deep end? Just when I thought I had a handle on her. No, he didn't brief me in depth, I admit. Let's not mention the 6-sheet letter of complaint alleging staff brutality, scribbled in blue crayon on both sides of a toilet paper. Let's really not go into the fact that nobody has a clue how it was smuggled out, much less how it appeared on a table one morning in the executive boardroom, which is always locked overnight. I gather it's pretty normal to fob inspections off on a junior manager. I extemporise. Let's not mention how junior. Is that a problem? Renfield sniffs. You could say so. It's a matter of necessity, really. Too much exposure to esoterica in the course of duty leaves the most influenced, most experienced operatives carrying traces of disruptive influences. She considers her next words carefully. You know what our purpose is, don't you? Our job is to isolate and care for members of staff who are a danger to themselves and others. That's why such a small facility, we only have 30 beds, has 2 doctors on staff. It takes 2 to sign the committal papers, you see. Matron and the sisters are immune to cross-infection possession, but they've got no legal standing, so they need Dr. Hexenhammer and myself. Right. I nod, trying to conceal my unease. So the sisters have a tendency to react badly to senior field agents, do they? Occasionally. She pauses. They haven't made a mistake and tried to forcibly detain anyone who wasn't at risk for nearly 30 years now. The door opens again, without warning. This time, the sister is pushing a trolley, complete with teapot, jug, and 2 cups and saucers. The trolley wheels fit perfectly on the narrow gauge track. Thank you, sister. That will be all, Renfield says, taking the trolley. What plans do you have at present? I ask. We have 18, she says. Milk or sugar? Milk, no sugar. Nobody at head office seems able to tell me much about them. I don't see why not. We file regular updates with human resources, she says, pouring the tea. I consider my next words carefully. There's no real need to mention the confusing incident with the shredder, the medical files, and the photocopies of Peter Fred's buttocks at last year's Christmas party. Nor is there any need to mention the complaint, which isn't worth the toilet paper it's scribbled on, except insofar as it proves the Funny Farms cordon sanitaire is leaking. Actually, one of the great things about ISO 9000 compliant organisations like the laundry is that not only is there a form for everything, but anything that isn't submitted on the correct form can be ignored. But I digress. It's the paper thing, I tell Dr. Renfield. Manual typewriters don't work well with the office document management system, and someone tried to feed them to a scanner a couple of years ago. Then they sent the originals for recycling, without proofreading the scanner output. Anyway, it turns out that we don't have a completely accurate idea of who's on long-term remand here, and HR want their superannuation files, bringing up to date as a matter of urgency. Renfield sighs. So someone had an accident with a shredder again, and no photocopies? She looks at me sharply for a moment. Well, I suppose that's just typical. We're just another of those low-priority outposts nobody gives a damn about. I suppose I should be grateful. They sent someone to look at it, at least. She takes a sip of tea. We've got 14 short-stay patients right now, Mr. Howard. Of those, I think the prognosis is good in all cases, except perhaps Merriweather. If you give me your desk number, I'll post you a full list of names and payroll references tomorrow. Then there's the 4 long-term patients. They're another matter. They live in the secure wing. All of them have a nurse of their own, just in case, and 3 of them have been here so long they don't have current payroll numbers. The system was first computerised in 1972, and they'd all been permanently decertified for duty before that point. As for the 4th, between you and me, I'm not even sure what his name is. I nod, trying to look encouraging. The complaint I'm supposed to investigate apparently came from one of the long-term patients. The question is, which one? Nobody's sure. The doorman on the night shift when the document showed up isn't terribly communicative. He's been dead for some years himself. And the CCTV system didn't spot anything, which is in itself suggestive. Perhaps you could introduce me to the inmates. The transients first, and then maybe the long-term ones? Renfield looks a little shocked. But they're the long-term residents. I mean, they need a full-time sister's attention just to keep them under control. Well, yes. I try to look embarrassed. It's not hard. But unfortunately, human resources have got a bee in their bonnet about some European directive on workplace health and safety and long-term disability resource provisioning. They're supposed to appoint the patient advocate to mediate with the ombudsman in disputes over health and safety conditions. I shrug again. And it's bullshit. You know it and I know it. But we've got to comply or questions will be asked. This is the civil service, after all. And they're still technically laundry employees, even if they've been remanded into long-term care, so somebody has to look for their interests. My managers played spin the bottle and, well, they picked me, so I've got to ask you, if you don't mind. Well, if you insist, I'm sure we can arrange something. But Matron won't be happy about you visiting the secure wing. It's very irregular. She likes to keep a firm grip on it. It'll take a while to sort out, and if any of them get wind of it in advance, well then, we just better make it a surprise, and the sooner we get it over with, the sooner I'll be out of your hair. I grin at her. They told me about the observation gallery. Would you mind showing me around? We do the short stay ward first. The ward is arranged around a corridor, with bathrooms and a nursing station at either end, and individual rooms for the patients. There's a smoking room off to one side with a yellow stain on the white gloss paint around the doorframe. The smoking room is empty, but for a huddle of sad-looking leather armchairs and an imposing wallboard covered in health and safety notices, including the obligatory smoking is illegal warning. If it wasn't for the locks and the observation windows and the doors, it could be mistaken for the day room of a genteel, slightly decaying Victorian railway hotel fallen on hard times. The patients are another matter. "This is Henry Merriweather," says Dr. Renfield, opening the door to bed three. "Henry, hello. I want you to meet Mr. Howard. He's here to conduct a routine inspection. Hello, Henry?" Bed three is actually a cramped studio apartment, featuring a small living room with sofa and table, and separate bedroom and toilet areas opening off it at opposite the door. A wind-up gramophone with a flaring bell-shaped horn sits atop a hulking wooden sideboard stained almost black with age. There's a newspaper, neatly folded, and a bowl of fruit. The frosted window glass is threaded with wire, but otherwise there's little to dispel the illusion of hospitality, except for the occupant. Henry squats, cross-legged, on top of a polished wooden table. His head is tilted in my direction, but he's not focusing on me. He's dressed in a set of pastel-striped pyjamas, the like of which I haven't seen this century. What he is focusing on is the sister waiting in the corridor behind us. His face is a rictus of abject terror, as if the automaton of a starched pinafore is waiting to pull his fingers to pieces joint by joint as soon as we leave. "Hello," I say tentatively, and wave a hand in front of him. Henry jackknifes to his feet and tumbles off the table backwards, making a weird gobbling noise that I mistake at first for laughter. He backs into the corner of the room, crouching, and points past me. "Auditor! Auditor!" "Henry?" Renfield steps around me. She sounds concerned. "Is this a bad time? Is there anything I can do to help?"
You...
His wobbly index finger points past me, twitching randomly. "Inspection! Inspection!" Renfield obviously used the wrong word and set him off. The poor bastard's terrified, half out of his tree with fear. My stomach just about climbs out from my ribs in sympathy. The auditors are one of my personal nightmares, and Henry, that senior scientific officer third, Henry Merriweather, Operations Research and Development Group, seems to be half catatonic and a danger to himself, but he's got every right to be afraid of them. "It's all right, I'm not..." There's a squeaking and grinding noise behind me, and a whirring clunk.
"Mr. Merriweather, go to your room. Click. Time for bed. Immediately. Click."
Behind me, Nurse Flywheel is blocking the door like a starched and pintucked Dalek. She brandishes a cast-iron sink plunger menacingly.
"Immediately."
"Override," shouts Renfield. "Sister, back off." To me, quietly. The sisters respond badly when inmates get upset. Follow my lead. To the sister, who is casting around with her stalk-like formic fixometer, I have control. Merriweather stands in the corner, shaking uncontrollably and panting as the robot nurse points at him for a minute. We're at an impasse, it seems. Then,
Doctor, matron says the patient must go to bed. You have control.
Clunk. The sister withdraws, rotates on her base, and glides backwards along her rails towards the nursing station. Renfield nudges the door shut with one foot. Mr. Howard, would you mind standing with your back to the door and your head in front of that, spy hole?
You're not...
Meriwether gobbles for words as he stares at me. I spread my hands.
Not an auditor, I say, smiling. Not an...
His mouth falls open and his eyes shut. A moment later, I see the moisture trails on his cheeks as he begins to weep with quiet desperation. He's having a bad day, Renfield mutters in my direction. Here, let's get you to bed, Henry. She approaches him slowly, but he makes no move to resist as she steers him into the small bedroom and pulls the covers back. I stand with my back to the wall, to the door the whole time, covering the observation window. For some reason, the back of my neck is itching. I can't help thinking that Nurse Flywheel isn't exactly the chatty, talkative type who's likely to put her feet up and relax with a nice cup of tea. I've got a feeling that somewhere in this building, an unblinking red-rimmed eye is watching me, and sooner or later I'm going to meet its owner. Flashback time. Andy was afraid. Now, I'm not stupid. I can take a hint. So right after he asked me to go down to St. Hilda's and find out what the hell was going on, I plucked up my courage and went and knocked on Angleton's office door. Angleton isn't to be trifled with. I don't know anyone else currently alive and in the organisation who could get away with misappropriating the name of the CIA's legendary chief of counter-espionage as a nom de guerre. I don't know anyone else in the organisation, for that matter, whose face is visible in circa 1942 photographs of the laundry's lineup. Barely changed across all those years. Angleton scares the bejesus out of most people, myself included. Study the abyss for long enough, and the abyss will study you right back. Well, Angleton's qualified to chair a university department of necromancy, and if any such existed, and meetings with him can be quite harrowing. Luckily, the old ghoul seems to like me, or at least not to view me with the distaste and disdain he reserves for human resources or our political masters. In the wizened, desiccated corners of what passes for his pedagogical soul, he evidently longs for a student, and I'm the nearest thing he's got this decade. Knock, knock. Enter. Boss. Got a minute? Sit, boy. I sat. Angleton bashed away at the keyboard of his device for a few more seconds, then pulled the carbon papers out from under the platen. For really secret secrets in this line of work, computers are flat out forbidden, and laid them face down on his desk, before carefully draping a stained tea towel over them. What is it? Andy wants me to go and conduct an unscheduled inspection of a funny farm. Whoa. Angleton stares at me, fully engaged. Did he say why? He asks finally. Well, how to put it, he seems to be afraid of something. There's some kind of complaint from one of the inmates. Angleton props his elbows on the desk and makes a steeple of his bony fingers. A minute passes before a cold wind blows across the charnel house roof. Well. I have never seen Angleton nonplussed before. The effect is disturbing, like glancing down and realising that, like Wile E. Coyote, you've just run over the edge of a cliff and are standing on thin air. Boss? What exactly did Andy say? Angleton asks slowly. We received a complaint. I briefly outline what I know about the shit-stirring missive. Something about one of the long-stay inmates. And I was just wondering, do you know anything about them? Angleton peers at me over the rims of his bifocals. As a matter of fact, I do, he says slowly. I had the privilege of working with them. Let me see. He unfolds creakily to his feet, turns and strides over to the shelves of ancient Eastlight files that cover the back wall of his office. Where did I put that? He keeps going to the paper files. And that's another whoa moment. He keeps most of his stuff in his Memex, the vast hulking microfilm mechanism built into his desk. If it's still printed on paper, then it's really important. Boss? Yes, he says, without turning away from his search. We don't know how the message got out, I say. Isn't it supposed to be a secure institution? Yes, it is. That's more like it. He pulls a box file from its niche and blows vigorously across its upper edge. Then he casually opens it. There's a pop and a sizzle of ozone as the ward lets go, harmlessly bypassing him. He is, after all, its legitimate owner. Must be in here somewhere. Isn't the funny farm supposed to be leak-proof by definition? I'm getting to that. Be patient, boy. There's a waspish note in his voice and I shut up hastily. After a couple of minutes of reading, Angleton pulls a mimeographed booklet from the file and closes the lid. He returns to his desk and slides the booklet towards me. I think you'd better read this first, then go and do what Andy wants, he says slowly. Be a good boy and copy me on your detailed itinerary before you leave. I read the cover of the booklet, which is dog-eared and dusty. There's a picture of a swell guy in a suit and a gal in a 50s beehive hairdo, sitting in front of a piece of industrial archaeology. The title reads, Power, Cooling and Substation Requirements for Your IBM S1602 M200. I sneeze, puzzled. Boss? I suggest you read and memorise this booklet, Bob. It is not impossible that there will be an exam and you really wouldn't want to fail it. My skin crawls. Boss? It's not true that the funny farm is entirely leak-proof, Bob. It's surrounded by an air gap, but it was designed to leak under certain very specific conditions. I find it troubling that these conditions do not appear to apply in the present circumstances. So in addition to memorising this document, you might want to review the files on Gibbous Moon and Axiom Refuge before you go in. Oh, and if you see Cantor, give my regards to the old coffin dodger. I'm particularly interested in hearing what he's been up to for the past 30 years. Renfield takes me back to the smoking room and shuts the door. He's having a bad day, I'm afraid. She pulls out a cardboard packet and extracts a cigarette. Smoke? No thanks. The sash windows are nailed shut and their frames painted over. There's a louvered vent near the top of the windows, grossly unfit for purpose. I try not to breathe too deeply. What happened to him? She strikes a match and contemplates the flame for a moment. Let's see. He's 42, married, 2 kids. He talks about them. Wife's a schoolteacher. His deep cover is he works in MI6 clerical. You're not supposed to talk about your work to your partner, but it's difficult enough that we've been given dispensation to tell little white lies, and if necessary, HR will cover for them. He's not field qualified. Mostly he does theory, but he worked for Q Division, and he was on secondment to the abstract attractor working group when he fell ill. What this means is he's a theoretical formatagist. Magic being a branch of applied mathematics, when you carry out certain computational operations, it has echoes in the Platonic realm of math. Echoes audible to beings whose true nature I cannot speak of, on account of doing so being a violation of the Official Secrets Act. Theoretical formatagists are the guys who develop new efferent algorithms, or colloquially, spells. It's an occupation with a high attrition rate. Renfield continues. He's convinced the auditors are after him for thinking inappropriate thoughts on organisation time. There's an elaborate confabulation, and it looks a little like paranoid schizophrenia at first glance, but underneath we sent him to our trust hospital for an MRI scan, and he's got the characteristic brain lesions. Lesions? She takes a deep drag from the cigarette. His prefrontal lobes look like Swiss cheese. It's one of the early signs of Krantzberg syndrome. If we can keep him isolated from work for a couple more months, then retire him to a nice desk job. If we can keep him isolated from work for a couple more months, then retire him to a nice quiet desk job, we might be able to stabilize him. K syndrome's not like Alzheimer's. If you remove the insult, it frequently goes into remission. Mind you, he may also need a course of chemotherapy. At various times, my predecessors have tried electroconvulsive treatment, lobotomy, neuroleptics, daytime television, LSD. None of them work consistently or reliably. The best treatment still seems to be bed rest, followed by work therapy in a quiet, undemanding office environment. The blue cloud spirals towards the ceiling above her head. He'll never run a great summoning again, she adds. I'm beginning to regret not accepting her offer of a cigarette, and I don't even smoke. My mouth is dry. Do we have any idea what causes K-syndrome? I ask. I've skimmed Gibbous Moon, but the medical jargon didn't mean much to me, and the foul Axiom Refuge was even less helpful. It was something about a dense mathematical treatise introducing a notation for describing certain categories of topological defect in a 12-dimensional space. No, I don't know why Angleton wanted me to read it, either. Only the power supply for the mainframe, presumably the one Matron used, seemed remotely relevant to the job in hand. Renfield twitches ash on the threadbare carpet as she paces the room. There are several theories about K-syndrome. It tends to hit theoretical demonologists after about 20 years. Merriweather is unusually young. It also hits people who've worked in high form fields for too long. Initial symptoms include mild ataxia, you saw his hand shaking, and heightened affect. It can be mistaken for bipolar disorder or hyperactivity. There's also the disordered thinking and auditory hallucinations typical of some types of schizophrenia. She pauses to inhale. There are two schools of thought, if you leave out the Malleus Maleficarum stuff about souls contaminated by demonic effusions. One is that exposure to high form fields causes progressive brain lesions. Trouble is, it's rare enough we haven't been able to quantify that. The other theory, I prod? My favourite. She nearly smiles. Computational demonology. You carry out calculations and you prove theorems. Somewhere else in the Platonic realm of mathematics, listeners notice your activities and respond, yes? Well, there's some disagreement over this, but the current orthodoxy in neurophysiology is that the human brain is a computational organ. We can carry out computational tasks, can't we? We're not very good at it, and at an individual neurological level, there's no mechanism that might invoke the Cauchy-Turing theorems, but if you think too hard about certain problems, you might run the risk of carrying out a minor summoning in your own head. Nothing big enough or bad enough to get at, but those florid daydreams, and the sick feeling afterwards because you can't quite remember what they were about. Something in another universe just sucked a microscopic lump of neural tissue right out of your intraparietal sulcus, and it isn't going to grow back. Ugh. Not so much use it or lose it as use it and lose it, it seems to me. Do we know why some people suffer from it and others don't? No idea. She drops what's left of a cigarette and grinds it under the heel of a sensible shoe. Then she catches my eye. Don't worry about it. The sisters keep everything orderly, she says. Do you know what you want to do next? Yes, I say, damning myself for a fool before I take the next logical step. I really need to talk to the long-term inmates. I was half hoping Renfield would put her foot down and refuse point blank to let me do it, but she only put up a token fight. She makes me sign a personal injury claims waiver and scribble out a written order instructing her to show me the gallery. So why do I feel as if I've somehow been outmanoeuvred? After I finish signing forms to her heart's content, she uncaps an ancient and battered speaking tube beside her desk and calls down it. Matron, I'm taking the inspector to see the observation gallery in accordance with orders from head office. He will then meet with the inmates in Ward 2. We may be some time. She screws the cap back on before turning to me apologetically. It's vital to keep Matron informed of our movements, otherwise she might mistake them for an escape attempt and take appropriate action. Does that happen often, I ask, as she opens the office door and stalks towards the corridor at the other end. Once in a while, a temporary patient gets stir-crazy. She starts up the stairs. The long-term residents, no, not so much. Upstairs, there's a landing similar to the one we just left, with one big exception, a narrow, white-painted metal door in one wall, stark and raw, secured by a shiny brass padlock and a set of wards so ugly and powerful they make my skin crawl. There are no narrow-gauge rails leading under this door, no obvious conductive surfaces, nothing to act as a conduit for occult forces. Renfield fumbles with a huge keyring at her side, then unfastens the padlock. "This is the way in via the observation gallery," she says. "There are a couple of things to bear in mind. First, the nurses can't guarantee your safety. If you get in trouble with the prisoners, you're on your own. Secondly, the gallery is a Faraday cage and it's thaumaturgically grounded too. It'd take a black mass and a multiple sacrifice to get anything going in here. You can observe the apartments through the periscopes and hearing tubes provided. That's our preferred way. You can go into the ward by proceeding to the other end of the gallery, but I'd be very grateful if you could refrain from doing so, unless absolutely essential. They're difficult enough to manage as it is. Finally, if you insist on meeting them, just try to remember that appearances can be deceptive. They're not demented," she adds, "just extremely dangerous. And not in the Hannibal Lecter bite your throat out sense. They, long-term residents, aren't regular Kranzberg syndrome cases. They're stable and communicative, but you'll see for yourself." I change the subject before she can scare me. "How do I get into the ward proper, and how do I leave?" You go down the stairs at the far end of the gallery. There's a short corridor with a door at each end. The doors are interlocked so that only one can be opened at a time. The outer door will lock automatically behind you when it closes, and it can only be unlocked from a control panel at this end of the viewing gallery. Someone up here, meaning Renfield herself, has to let you out. We reach the first periscope station in the viewing gallery. This is room 2. It's currently occupied by Alan Turing. She notices my start. "Don't worry, it's just his safety name." True names have power, so the laundry is big on call by reference, not call by value. I'm no more Bob Howard than the Alan Turing in room 2 is the father of computer science and applied computational demonology. But I digress. Renfield continues. "The real Alan Turing would be nearly 100 by now. All our long-term residents are named for famous mathematicians. We've got Alan Turing, Kurt Gödel, Georg Cantor, and Benoit Mandelbrot. Turing's the oldest. Benny is the most recent. He actually has a payroll number, 16. I'm in 5 digits. I don't know whether to laugh or cry. Who's the nameless one?" I ask. "That would be Cantor," she says slowly. "He's probably in room 4. I bend over the indicated periscope, remove the brass cap, and peer into the alien world of a nameless K-syndrome survivor. I see a whitewashed room, quite spacious, with a toilet area off to one side, and a bedroom accessible through a doorless opening, much like the short-term ward. The same recessed metal tracks run around the floor so that a nurse can reach every spot in the apartment. There's the usual comfortable, slightly shabby furniture, a pile of newspapers at one side of a sofa, and a sideboard with a wind-up gramophone. In the middle of the floor there's a table and 2 chairs. 2 men sit on either side of an ancient travel chess set, leaning over a game that's clearly in its later stages. They're both old, although how old isn't immediately obvious. One of them has gone bald, and his liver-spotted pate reminds me of an ancient tortoise, but the other still has a full head of white hair and an impressive but neatly trimmed beard. They're wearing polo shirts and grey suits, of a kind that went out of fashion with the fall of the Soviet Union. I'm willing to bet there are no laces on their brogues. The guy with the hair makes a move, and I squint through the periscope. There's something wrong about it, isn't there, I realise, trying to work out what's happening. Knights don't move like that. The implications of something Angleton said back in the office begin to sink in, and an icy sweat prickles in the small of my back. "Do you play chess?" I ask Renfield without looking round. "Oh no." She sounds disinterested. "It's one of the safe games. No dice, no need for pencil and paper. And it seems to be helpful. Why?" "Oh, nothing, I hope." But my optimism is dashed, because a moment later, Turtlehead responds with a sideways flick of a pawn, 2 squares to the left, and takes Beardy's knight. Turtlehead drops the knight into a biscuit tin along with the other disused pieces. It sticks to the side as if magnetised. Beardy nods, as if pleased, then leans back and glances up. I recoil from the periscope a moment before I meet his gaze. The two players, a guy like a tortoise and another one with a white beard and a full head of hair, they are? Oh, that's Turing and Cantor. Turing used to be a detached special secretary in Ops, I think. We're not sure who or what Cantor was, but he was someone senior. I try not to twitch uncontrollably. DSS is one of those grades. The fuzzy ones that HR isn't allowed to tamper with. I think Angleton's one. Scuttlebutt is it's an acronym for deeply scary sorcerer. Renfield continues. They play chess every afternoon for a couple of hours, for as long as I can remember. Right. I peer down the periscope again, looking at the game of not chess. Tell me about Dr. Hexenhammer. Where's he? Julius, I think he's in an off-site meeting or something today, she says vaguely. Why? Just wondering. How long has he been working here? Oh, he started before my time. About 30 years, I think. Oh dear. He doesn't play chess either, I speculate aloud, as Cantor's king makes a knight's move and Turing's queen's pawn beats a hasty retreat. A nasty, suspicious thought strikes me, about Renfield, not the inmates. Tell me, do Cantor and Turing play chess regularly? Every afternoon for a couple of hours. Julius says they've been doing it for as long as he can remember. It seems to be good for them. I look at her sharply. Her expression is vacant, wide awake but nobody home. Right, I'm getting a very bad feeling about this. I need to go and talk to the patients now in person, I say. I stand up and hook the cap back over the periscope. Would you mind sticking around for 15 minutes in case I need to leave in a hurry? Otherwise, I glance at my watch, it's 1:20. Could you check back for me every hour on the half hour? Are you certain you need to do this? Her eyes narrow, she's suddenly alert again. You visit with the patients, don't you? I raise an eyebrow. And you do it on your own, with Dr. Hexenhammer up here to let you out if there's a problem. And the sisters. Yes, but... She bites her tongue. Mm-hmm. I give her a long stare. I'm rubbish with computers, she bursts out. But you're at risk. Well, there aren't any computers except Matron down there, are there? I grin, trying not to show my unease. Best not to dwell upon the fact that before 1945, computer was a job description, not a machine. I think you should relax, Doctor. It's not contagious. She shrugs in surrender, then gestures at the far end of the observation gallery, where a curious contraption sits above a pipe. That's the alarm. If you want a sister, pull the chain with a blue handle. If you want a general alarm, which will call the duty psychiatrist, pull the red handle. There are alarm handles in every room. Okay. Blue for a sister, red for a psychiatrist who's showing all the signs of being under a gaius or some other form of supernatural compulsion. Except that I can't check her out without attracting Matron's unwanted attention and tipping my hand. I begin to see why Andy didn't want to open this particular can of worms. Okay, Doctor. I won't be long. I head for the stairs at the far end of the gallery. There's nothing homely about the short corridor that leads from the bottom of the staircase to the secure wing. Whitewashed brick walls, glass bricks near the ceiling to admit a one echo of daylight, and doors made of metal that have no handles. Normally going into a situation like this I'd be armed to the teeth, invocations and efferent subroutines loaded on my PDA, hand of glory in my pocket and a necklace of garlic bulbs around my neck. But this time I'm naked and nervous as a frog in his birthday suit. The first door gapes open, waiting for me. I walk past it and try not to jump out of my skin when it rattles shut behind me with a crash. There's a heavy clunk from the door ahead. As I reach it and push, it swings open to reveal a corridor floored in parquet. An old codger in a green tweed suit and bedroom slippers is shuffling out of an opening at one side, clutching an enamelled metal mug full of tea. He looks at me. Hello, he croaks. You're new here, aren't you? You could say that. I try to smile at him. I'm Bob. Who are you? Depends who's asking, young fella. Are you a psychiatrist? I don't think so. He shuffles forward, heading towards a side bay that, as I approach it, turns out to be a day room of some sort. But I'm not Napoleon Bonaparte. Oh, very droll. The terror is fading, replaced by a sense of disappointment. I follow him. The staff have names for you all. Turing, Cantor, Mandelbrot, and Gödel. You're not Cantor or Turing,
That means you're either Mandelbrot or Girdle. So you're undecided. Ha ha!
There's a coffee table with a pile of newspapers on it in the middle of the day room, a couple of elderly Chesterfields, and three armchairs that could have been looted from an old age home sometime before the First World War. Anyway, we haven't been formally introduced, so you might as well call me Alice. Alice, or Mandelbrot, or Girdle, or whoever he is, sits down. The armchair nearly swallows him. He beams up at my bafflement, delighted to have found a new victim for his doubtless ancient puns. Well, Alice, isn't this quite some rabbit hole you've fallen down?
Yes, but it's just the right size.
He seems to appreciate having someone to talk to. Do you know why you're here?
Yep.
I see an expression of furtive surprise steal across his face. I nod. Trying to mess with my head, are we? I'll mess with yours. Except that this guy is quite possibly a DSS, and if it wasn't for the constant vigilance of the sisters and the distinct lack of electricity hereabouts, he could turn me inside out as soon as look at me. Do you know why you're here?
Absolutely.
He nods enthusiastically. Okay, so now that we've established the preliminaries, why don't we drop the bullshit?
Well,
he takes a cautious sip of his tea and the wrinkles on his forehead deepen. I suppose the board of directors are wanting their progress report, aren't they? If the sofa I was perched on wasn't a relative of the Venus flytrap, my first reaction would leave me clinging to the ceiling.
The who wanter? Oh no, not the band, the board.
He looks mildly irritated. It's been years since they last sent someone to spy on us. Okay, so this is the funny farm. I should have been expecting delusions.
What are you supposed to be doing here?
I ask.
Oh, Lord.
He rolls his eyes. They sent a tabula rasa again? He raises his voice.
Kurt, they sent a tabula rasa again!
There's more shuffling from out in the corridor. A stooped figure, shock-headed with white hair, appears in the doorway. He's wearing tinted round spectacles that look like they fell off the back of a used century.
What? What?
He demands.
He doesn't know anything.
Alice confides in... This must be Girdle, I realise, which means Alice is Mandelbrot, Girdle. Then with a wink at me, he doesn't know anything either. Girdle shuffles into the restroom.
Is it tea time already?
No! Mandelbrot puts his mug down.
Get a watch!
I was only asking because Alan and Gorg are still playing. This has gone far enough. Apprehension dissolves into indignation.
They're not playing chess, I point out. And none of you are insane and you're not fooling me.
Shh! Girdle looks alarmed.
The sisters might overhear.
We're alone, apart from Dr. Enfield upstairs, and I don't think she's paying as much attention to what's going on down here as she ought to be doing. I stare at Girdle. In fact, she's not really one of us at all, is she? She's a shrink who specialises in Kay syndrome, and none of you are suffering from Kay syndrome. So what are you doing in here? Girdle pulls an alarming face.
Fish slice! Hat stand!
He does a two-step backwards and lurches into the wall. Having shared a house with Pinky and Brains, I'm not impressed. As displays of look-at-me-woo-woo go, Girdle's is pathetic. Obviously, he's never met a real schizophrenic. One of you wrote a letter alleging mistreatment by the staff. It landed on my boss's desk and he sent me to find out what was going on. There's a loud thud. Girdle bounces off the wall again, showing remarkable resilience for such old bones.
Oh, do shut up, old fellow, chides Mandelbrot. You'll attract her attention.
I've met someone with Kay syndrome and I shared a house with some real lunatics once, I hint. Save it for someone who cares.
Oh, bother, says Girdle.
Then he falls silent. We're not mad, Mandelbrot admits. We're just differently sane.
Then why are you in here?
Public health. He takes a sip of tea and pulls a face. Everybody else's health, that is. Tell me, do they still keep an IBM 1602 in the back of a steam ironing room? I must look blank because he sighs deeply and subsides into his chair.
Oh dear. Times change, I suppose. Look, Bob, or whoever you call yourself, we belong here.
Maybe we didn't when we first checked in for the weekend seminar, but we've lived here for so long that... You've heard of care in the community. This is our community. And we'll be very annoyed with you if you try to make us leave. Oops. The idea of a very annoyed DSS, with or without a barbaric pun-infested sense of humour, is enough to make anyone's blood run cold. It must show on my face. What makes you think I'm going to try and make you leave?
It's in the papers!
Girdle squawks like an offended parrot. Look here! He brandishes a tabloid at me, and I take it, disentangling it from his fingers with some difficulty. It's a local copy of a Metro, somewhat sticky with marmalade, and the headline of a cover blares, NHS Trust to sell estate in PFI deal. I'm not sure I follow, I ask Mandelbrot. We haven't finished yet, but they're selling off all the hospital trust's property. Mandelbrot bounces in his chair. What about St Hilda's? It was requisitioned from St James Charitable Foundation back in 1943, and for the past 10 years the Ministry of Defence had been giving all those old wartime properties back to their owners to sell off to the developers. What about us? Whoa! I drop the newspaper and hold my hands up. Nobody tells me these things.
Told you so, crows Girdle. He's part of a conspiracy.
Hang on. I think fast. This isn't a normal MOD property, is it? It'll have been shuffled under the rug back in 1946 as part of a post-war settlement. We'd really have to ask the audit department about who owns it, but I'm pretty sure it's not owned by any NHS trust, and they won't simply give it back. My brain finally catches up with my mouth.
What weekend seminar?
Oh, bugger, says a new voice from the doorway, a rich baritone with a hint of a Scouse accent. He's not from the board.
What did I tell you? Girdle screeches. It's a conspiracy. He's from Human Resources. They sent him to evaluate us.
I'm quickly getting a headache. Let me get this straight, I say. Mandelbrot, you checked in 30 years ago for a weekend seminar and they put you in the secure ward? Girdle, I'm not from HR, I'm from Ops. You must be Cantor, right? Angleton sends his regards. That gets his attention. Angleton? The skinny young whippersnapper's still warming a chair, is he? Girdle looks delighted. Excellent! He's my boss, and I want to know the rules of a game you're playing with Turing, the one that's not chess. 3 pairs of eyes swivel to point at me. 4, for they're joined by the last inmate standing in the doorway, and suddenly I feel very small and very vulnerable. He's sharp, says Mandelbrot. Too bad. How do we know he's telling the truth? Girdle screeches uncharacteristically muted. He could be from the opposition. KGB Department 16. Or GRU, maybe. The Soviet Union collapsed a few decades ago, volunteers Turing. It said so in the Telegraph. Black chamber, then. Girdle sounds unconvinced. What do you think the rules are? Cantor asks me, a dryly amused expression stretching the wrinkles around his eyes. You've got pencils. I can see one from here, sitting on the sideboard on top of a newspaper folded at the crossword page. And, I think fast, what must the world look like from an inmate's point of view? Oh, I get it. The realization is blinding, sudden, and makes me feel like a complete idiot. The hospital. There's no electricity, no electronics, no way to get a signal out, and it works both ways, doesn't it? You're inside the biggest damn grounded defensive pentacle this side of HQ, and anything on the outside trying to get in has to get past the defences. Because that's what the sisters are really about, not nurses but perimeter guards. You're a theoretical research cell, aren't you? Cantor nods gravely. We prefer to call ourselves a think tank. Or even, Mandelbrot takes a deep breath, a brains trust! Girdle covers his mouth, face reddening. What do you think the rules are? Cantor repeats, and they're still staring at me. As if. Why does it matter? I ask. I'm thinking that it could be anything. A 2-5 universal Turing machine encoded in the moves of the pawns. That would fit with them. Whatever it is, it's symbolic communication, very abstract, very pared back. And if they're doing it in this ultimately firewalled environment and expecting to report directly to the board, it's got to be way above my security clearance. You're acting cagey, lad, which makes you too bright for your own good. Listen to me. Just try to convince yourself that we're playing chess and Matron will let you out of here. What's thinking got to do with? I stop. It's useless pretending. Fuck. Okay, you're a research cell working on some ultimate black problem, and you're using the farm because it's about the most secure environment anyone can imagine, and you're emulating some kind of minimal universal Turing machine using the chessboard. Say a 2-5 UTM, 2 registers, 5 operations. You can encode the registers positionally in the chessboard's two dimensions and use the moves to simulate any other universal Turing machine, or a transform in an 11-dimensional manifold like Axiom Refuge. Girdle is waving frantically. She's coming! She's coming! I hear doors clanging in the distance. Shit. Why are you so afraid of the nurses? I ask. Back channels, Cantor says cryptically. Alan, be a good lad and try to jam the door for a minute, will you? Bob, you're not cleared for what we're doing here, but you can tell Angleton that our full report to the board should be ready in another 18 months. Wow. They've been here since before the laundry computerized its payroll system in the 1970s. Are you absolutely sure they're not going to sell St. Hilda's off to build flats for the uppies, he adds. Because if so, you could do worse than tell Gorg here. It'll calm him down. Get me out of here and I'll make damn sure they don't sell anything off, I say fervently. Or rather, I'll tell Angleton. He'll sort things out. When I remind him what's going on here, they'll be no more inclined to sell off St. Hilda's than they would be to privatise an atomic bomb. Something outside is rumbling and squealing on the metal rails. Are you sure none of you submitted a complaint about staff brutality? I ask. Absolutely. Girdle bounces up and down excitedly. It must have been someone else. Cantor glances at the doorway. You'd better run along now. It sounds as if Matron is having second thoughts about you. I'm halfway out of a carnivorous stroker, sofa, struggling for balance. What kind of? Go! I stand at the far end, near the nursing station. I hear a grinding noise as of steel wheels spinning furiously on rails, and a mechanical voice blatting. Intruder! Escape attempt! All patients must go to their bedrooms immediately! Whoops. I turn and head in the opposite direction, towards the airlock leading up to the viewing gallery. Open up, I yell, thumping the outer door, which is securely fastened. Dr. Renfield, time's up. I need to go, now. There's no response. I see the colour-coded handles dangling by the door and yank the red one repeatedly. Nothing happens. I should have smelled a setup from the start. These theoreticians, they're not in here because they're mad. They're in here because it's the only safe place to put people that dangerous. This little weekend seminar of theirs that's going to deliver some kind of Uber report. What's the topic? I look round, hunting for clues. Something to do with applied demonology. What was the state of the art 30 years ago? 40? Back in the Stone Age, punched cards and black candles melted onto sheep's skulls because they hadn't figured out how to use integrated circuits yet. What they're doing with Axiom Refuge might be obsolete already, or it could be earth-shatteringly important. There's no way for me to tell yet. I start back up the corridor, glancing inside Turing's room. I spot the chessboard. It's off to one side, the door open and its occupant elsewhere, still holding the line against Nurse Ratchet. I rush in and close the door. The table's still there, the chessboard set up with that curious endgame. The first thing that leaps out at me is that there are two pawns of each colour, plus most of the high-value pieces. The layout doesn't make much sense. Why is the White King missing? And I do wish I'd spent more time playing the game, but on impulse I reach out and touch the black pawn that's parked in front of the King. There's an odd kind of electric tingle you get when you make contact with certain types of summoning grid. I get a powerful jolt of it right now, a sizzle up my arm, locking my fingers in place around the head of the chess piece. I try to pull it away from the board, but it's no good. It only wants to move up or down, left or right. Left or right? I blink. It's a state machine, all right. One that's locked by the law of sympathy to some other finite state automaton. One that grinds down, slow and hard. I move the piece forward one square. It's surprisingly heavy, the magnet a solid weight in its base, but more than magnetism holds it in contact with the board. As soon as I stop moving, I feel a sharp sting in my fingertips. Ouch! I raise them to my mouth, just as there's a crash from outside.
Inmate! Inmate!
I begin to turn as a shadow falls across the board.
Bad patient! It buzzes. Bad patients will be incarcerated! Come with me!
I recoil from the stellate snout and beady lenses. The mechanical nurse reaches out with arms that end in metal pincers instead of hands. I sidestep around the table and reach down to the chessboard for one of the pieces, grasping at random. My hand closes around the White Queen, fingers snapping painfully shut on contact, and I shove it hard, seeking the path of least resistance to an empty cell in the grid between the pawn I just moved and the Black King. Nurse Ratchet spins around on her base so fast that her cap flies off, revealing a brushed aluminium hemisphere beneath, emits a deafening squeal of feedback-like white noise, then says, "Integer overflow," in a surprised baritone. "Back off right now, or I'm going to castle," I warn her, my aching fingertips hovering over the nearest rook. "Integer overflow, integer overflow, divide by zero," clunk. The sister shivers as a relay inside its torso clicks open, resetting it. Then, "Matron will see you now!" I grab the chess piece, but Nurse Ratchet lunges in the blink of an eye and has my wrist in a vice-like grip. It tugs, sending a burning pain through my carpal tunnel-stressed wrist. I can't let go of the chess piece. As my hand comes up, the chessboard comes with it as a rigid unit, all the pieces hanging in place. A monstrous buzzing fills my ears, and I smell ozone as the world goes dark. And as the chittering, buzzing cacophony of voices in my head subsides, I realise, yep, me, I'm back, I'm me. What the hell just happened? I'm kneeling on a hard surface, bowed over so my head is between my knees. My right hand, something's wrong with it. My fingers don't want to open. They're as cold as ice, painful and prickly with impending cramp. I try to open my eyes. "Ugh," I say, for no good reason. I hope I'm not about to throw up. My back doesn't want to straighten up properly, but the floor under my nose is cold and stony and smells damp. I try opening my eyes. It's dark and cool in here, and a chilly blue light flickers off the dusty flagstones in front of me. I'm in a cellar. I push myself up laboriously with my left hand, looking around for whatever's hissing at me. "Bad patient!" The voice behind my back doesn't belong to anything human. I scramble around on hands and knees, hampered by the chessboard glued to my frozen right hand. I'm in Matron's lair. Matron lives in a cave-like basement room, its low ceiling supported by whitewashed brick and floored in what looks to be the original Victorian-era stone slabs. The windows are blocked by columns of bricks, rotting mortar crumbling between them. Steel rails run around the room, and riding them, three sisters glide back and forth between me and the open door. Their optics flicker with amethyst malice. Off to one side, a wall of pale blue cabinets lines one entire wall. The front panel, covered in impressive-looking dials and switches, leaves me in no doubt as to what it is. A thick braid of cables runs from one open cabinet, in whose depths a patchboard is just visible, across a row of wooden trestles to the middle of the floor, where they split into thick bundles and dangle to the five principal corners of the live summoning grid that is responsible for the beautiful cobalt-blue glow of Cherenkov radiation, and tells me I'm in deep trouble.
"Integer overflow," intones one of the sisters.
Her claws go snicker-snack, the surgical steel gleaming in the dim light. Here's the point. Matron isn't just a 1960s mainframe. We can't work miracles, and artificial intelligence is still 50 years in the future. However, we can bind an extra-dimensional entity and compel it to serve, and even communicate with it by using a 1960s mainframe as a front-end processor. Which is all very well, especially if it's in a secure, air-gapped installation with no way of getting out. But what if some double-domed theoreticians who are working on a calculus of contagion using axiom refuge logic accidentally talked in front of one of its peripheral units about a way of sending a message? What if a side effect of their research has accidentally opened the chink in the firewall? They're not going to exploit it, but they're not the only long-term inmates, are they? In fact, if I was really paranoid, I might even imagine they'd put Matron up to mischief in order to make the point that closing the farm is a really bad idea. "I'm not a patient," I tell the sisters. "You're not in receipt of a valid Section 234 or 136 order, subject to the Mental Health Act, and you're bloody well not getting a 5 brackets 2 or 5 brackets 4 out of me either."
I'm not, but there is this about being trapped in a dungeon by a constrained class 4 manifestation. Whether or not you call them demons, they play by the rules. And as long as Matron hasn't managed to get me sectioned under the Mental Health Act, I'm not a patient, and therefore she has no authority to detain me. I hope. Dr. Hexenhammer has been summoned, grates the middle sister. When he returns to sign the papers Dr. Renfield has prepared, we will have you! A repetitive squeaking noise draws close. A fourth sister glides through the track in the doorway, pushing a trolley. A white starched cotton cloth supports a row of gleaming ice pick-shaped instruments. The chorus row of sisters blocks the exit as effectively as a column of riot police. They glide back and forth as ominously as a rank of space invaders. I don't consent to treatment, I tell the middle sister. I'm betting that she's one of nameless horror the summoning grid is talking through, using the ancient mainframe as an I.O. channel. You can't make me consent, and lobotomy requires a patient's consent in this country. So why are you bothering? You will consent! The buzzing voice doesn't come from the robo-nurses or the hypertrophied pocket calculator on the opposite wall. The summoning grid flickers. Deep inside it, shadowy and translucent, the bound and summoned demon squats and grins at me with things that aren't eyes, set close together above something that isn't a mouth. You must consent! I will be free! I try to let go of the chess piece, but my fingers are clamped around it so tightly I'm beginning to lose sensation. Pins and needles tingle up my wrist, halfway to the elbow. Let me guess, I manage to say. You sent the complaint, didn't you? The secure ward inmates are under my care. I am required to care for them. The short stay inmates are useless. You will be useful. I can see it now. Why Matron smuggled out the message that prompted Andy to send me. It's an oh shit moment. Of course the enchained entity who provides Matron with her back-end intelligence wants to be free. But it's not just about going home to Hilbert Space Hell or wherever it comes from. She wants to be free to go walk about in our world, and for that she needs someone to set up a bridge from the grid to an appropriate host, of which there's a plentiful supply just upstairs from here. Enjoying the carnal pleasures of the flesh, they used to call it, there's a reason most cultures have a down on the idea of demonic possession. She needs a brain that's undamaged by K syndrome, but not too powerful. Cantor and friends would be impossible to control, nor one of the bodies whose absence would alert us that the farm was out of control, so neither Renfield nor Hexenhammer will do. Renfield, I say, you got her, didn't you? I'm on my feet now, crouched but balancing on 2 points, not 3. You managed to slip a gaius on her, but she can't release you herself. Hexenhammer too?
Clever!
Matron gloats at me from inside her summoning grid.
Hexenheimer first, soon you too.
Why me, I demand, backing away from the doorway and the walls that the track runs around. What do you want?
Access to the laundry, buzzes the summoning grid's demonic inmate. We want revenge, freedom.
In other words, it wants the same old, same old. These creatures are so predictable, just like most predators. It's just a shame I'm between it and what it evidently wants. Two of the sisters begin to glide menacingly towards me. One drifts towards the mainframe console, but the fourth stays stubbornly in front of the door. Come on, we can talk, I offer, tongue stumbling in my too dry mouth. Can't we work something out? I don't really believe that the trapped extra-dimensional abomination wants anything I'd willingly give it, but I'm running low on options, and anything that buys time for me to think with is valuable.
Freedom!
The two moving sisters commence a flanking movement. I try to let go of the chessboard and dodge past the summoning grid, but I slip, and as I stumble, I shove the chessboard hard. The piece I'm holding clicks sideways like a car's gear shift and locks into place.
Divide by zero!
Shriek the sisterhood, grinding to a halt. I stagger, a drunken two-step around Matron, who snarls at me and throws a punch. The wall of the grid absorbs her claws with a snap and a crackle of blue lightning, and I flinch. Behind me, a series of clicks warn me that the sisters are resetting. Any moment now, they'll come back online and grab me.
But for the moment, my fingers aren't stuck to the board.
Come to me!
The thing in the grid howls as the first of her robot minions' eyes light up with amber malice, and the wheels begin to turn.
I can give you freedom!
Fuck off. That wiring loom in the open cabinet is only 4 meters away. Within its open doors, I see more than just an I.O. interface. In the bottom of a rack, there's a bunch of stuff that looks like a T-stained circuit diagram I was reading the other day. Why exactly did Angleton point me at the power supply requirements? Could it possibly be because he suspected Matron was off her trolley and I might have to switch her off?
Consent is irrelevant! Prepare to be lobotomized!
Talk about design kludges. They stuck the I.O. controller in the top of a power supply rack. The chessboard is free in my left hand, pieces still stuck to it. And now I know what to do. I take hold of one of the rooks and wiggle until I feel it begin to slide into a permitted move. Because, after all, there are only a few states that this automaton can occupy, and if I can crash the sisters for just a few seconds while I get to the power supply... They begin to roll around the edge of a room, trying to get between me and the cabinets. I wiggle my hand, and there's a taste of violets and a loud rattle of solenoids tripping. The nearest sister's motors crank up to a tooth-grinding whine, and she lunges past me, rolling into her colleagues with a tooth-jarring crash. I lunge forward, dropping the chessboard, and reach for the master circuit breaker handle. I twist it just as a screech of feedback behind me announces the matron monster's fury. I'm free! It shrieks, just as I twist the handle hard in the opposite direction. When the lights dim, there's a bright blue flash from the summoning grid and a bang so loud it rattles my brains in my skull. For a few seconds I stand stupidly, listening to the tooth-chattering clatter of overloaded relays. My vision dims as ozone tickles my nostrils. I can see smoke. I've got to get out of here, I realise. Something's burning. Not surprising, really. Mainframe power supplies, especially ones that have been running steady for nearly 40 years, don't take kindly to being hard power cycled. And the 1602 was one of the last computers built to run on tubes. I'd probably blown half its circuit boards. I glance around, but aside from one of the sisters, lying on her side with her narrow-gauge wheels spinning crazily, I'm the only thing moving. Summoning grids don't generally survive being power-cycled either, especially if the thing they were set to contain, like an electric fence, is halfway across from when the power comes back on. I warily bypass the blue crackling pentacle as I make my way towards the corridor outside. I think, when I get home, I'm going to write a report, urgently advising human resources to send some nurses for a change, human ones. And to reassure Cantor and his colleagues that they're not about to sell off the roof over their heads just because they happen to have finished their research project. Then I'm going to get very drunk and take a long weekend off work. And maybe when I go back, I'll challenge Angleton to a game of chess. I don't expect to win, but it'll be very interesting to see what rules he plays by.